This is the Blossom of Thought podcast, a podcast about the body, mind, and soul. And your host is Mpilo Kambule.
We are back with another episode. This time we want to talk about Guinea-Bissau and the recent developments there as far as the political upheavals. Africa is on fire in various dimensions, but we are going to focus on Guinea-Bissau. There are a lot of people who are suffering on the ground because of, as Kwame Ture will say, that our problem is more of a political one than an economic one, and we must sort that problem. In Guinea-Bissau, they are struggling, the comrades on the ground, so that we can sort that political problem. As it has been said before, it will also say it now, that the independence of Guinea-Bissau means nothing without the independence of other African countries. And the independence of other African countries are meaningless without the independence of Guinea-Bissau. Amilcar Cabral is a famous figure associated with Guinea-Bissau and also the political party that he established way back there in the late 50s. It's called the African Party of Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. Amilcar Cabral was nominated by journalists as the second greatest leader in the history of mankind. And joining me today to speak about Guinea-Bissau and the politics thereon is Imanina Umocha, who serves in the political bureau of the African Party of Independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, that is the PAGC. He also serves on the National Secretariat of the PAGC as a director of the PAGC Amilcar Cabral Political Ideological Training School. Imani is a member of the Central Committee of the All African People Revolutionary Party. He also serves on the Coordination Council of the West African People's Organization, that is WAPO, and is a member of the Steering Committee of the Black Alliance for Peace, U.S. Out of Africa Network. Brother Imani, welcome to the show.
Thank you, my brother and comrade. Thank you for having us on your show today to share with our listening audience and all of our comrades who will see this video, so they can learn from we learn from others.
Of course. At the head of this, I mentioned that Africa is on fire. Talk to us just as an introduction what that means, because I saw you nodding your head.
Yeah, I agree with you. Africa's on fire, and the fire started a long time ago, but sometimes it gets hotter than other times. We have to understand that Africa, being one of the richest continents in the world, is strategically located geographically speaking. It has very, very fertile land. It has a lot of resources. Just in Guinea-Bissau, one of the smallest of the 55 countries in Africa, we got more than 100 different minerals, of which some are very strategic. We have very deep water wells. In Guinea-Bissau, we have the third deepest well of all of Africa. So since Africa is so important geographically speaking, it's so rich. Then you have those others who were born in countries that were poor. They have less fertile land. They had to go to other places with violence to occupy these lands and to exploit the people so that they can get richer while we get poor living on our own land. But it's only natural that our people, because of our human instinct, will react in favor of justice. We will resist. And so as time goes on, we learn from the mistakes of the past, and our resistance becomes more qualitatively. As a result of the resistance becoming more qualitative, and we begin to take some of our land back. And we took some of our land back, we begin to organize it, to use it to get the rest of the land. So a crisis has been increasing in those countries we call the imperialist countries. The capitalist countries, where you have one small class of those who own the resource of that land and exploit the working class, so that the working class does all the work but eats very little of its fruits of its labor. Whereas the capitalist class, the ruling class, does very little work and eats most of the fruits of the labor. So when they leave the country, like for example, they leave capitalist Britain or capitalist France or capitalist whatever country they leave, and they come to another country like China or Swaziland or Guinea-Bissau or El Salvador, then they'll exploit the people that land in this resource. But of course, then the people in these lands too, they fight back. Different levels. So what's been happening recently is, when I say recent, I mean like the past 50, 60 years, is that as a result of victories of these organizations, our people have learned that the best organizations for us to have is a party. And the party has to have a program where the program says, okay, our objective is this, our strategy to achieve our objective is that, and the tactics we're going to use, the tactics we will use to implement our strategy is this, that, and the other. Of course, that can change on a daily basis. But as a result of that, we're becoming more mature politically, and we've been exchanging ideas with each other. It's like what we're doing today. We're taking advantage of the different technology and means that exist to exchange ideas with each other to learn. So in a nutshell, the level of political maturity has been seriously increasing. And as a result of that, the reaction is that capitalist class that promotes imperialism goes through more of a crisis. Just to give you an example, a lot of people might not know it, but the main currency used to do exchanges throughout the world is the U.S. dollar. Now, those who live in the U.S. might think, okay, well, we got a strong strong dollar? No, it's not that. It's a result of wars. The first imperialist war, which is called World War One. The second imperialist war, which is called World War Two, and had some shifts. For example, before the first imperialist war, the strongest currency in the world was the British pound, sterling. Second to that was the French franc. But after the second imperialist war, new financial institutions were set up. What we call the Bretton Woods institutions. We got the International Development Agency. The full name is the World Bank for Reconstruction of Europe. Reconstruction and Development of Europe. But now people just call it the World Bank. But the name is the World Bank for the Reconstruction and Development of Europe. And the International Monetary Fund. Some people just call it the International IMF. They use abuse in this institution to control the economies of many, many countries in the world. But they come under guys, they come in to help you. Okay, your country, you don't have enough money. You want money to develop this, to develop that. Okay, we're going to lend you money. But to lend you the money, you have to do this, that, and other. You have preconditions. For example, you have to take your port or your airport, you sell it to private owners. They've been controlled by the state. Or they tell you, okay, you got too many teachers teaching in your school, so you have to lay some of those off. Or you got too many doctors or health workers in your health system, so you have to lay those off or fire them. So they give you all these preconditions, and then they give you all these expensive service fees to pay, and then they give you this exploitative interest rates to pay. So what happens is you might effectively have been lent $20 million for a year, but you don't pay it back in a year. And sometimes you don't even finish paying it back. But in the long run, you end up paying back not $20 million, you end up paying back maybe $70, $80 million. And you get your economy collapse, controlled by them, because it's for their benefit. So now they're going through these crises because the people are more organized in the world. Now you have other alternatives. For example, you have some serious initiative to take the many countries away from the U.S. dollar, to have other currencies. Some of the initiatives, one was started by Hugo Chavez, Muammar Gaddafi, Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Muammar Gaddafi in Libya, with others. They brought together the overwhelming majority of the countries in Africa and all the countries of Latin America, all 33 of them, as say all the countries in the American continent, the Western Hemisphere, with the exception of Canada and the U.S., they formed the Economic Community. They call it CELAC, the Economic Community of Latin America and the Caribbean. And then they brought their community together with those who were inside of the newly established at that time African Union. And they decided that one of the decisions they made was they were going to take their gold out of the banks of the U.S. and England and France and bring it back to their own countries. And they would start doing trade using their own currencies. And eventually they would make a currency based upon gold. They started in Africa too. They called it the dinar. So now instead of using dollar or euro, they're going to start using a gold coin called dinar. Now what does that mean? That means that the dominance of the U.S. dollar would fall. And when the dominance of the U.S. dollar falls, that means capitalism in the United States will go through a serious crisis, as well as the other countries that have serious influence by the U.S. dollar, like in most of Western Europe and even other countries in Eastern Europe right now. The other initiative that happened was what's called BRIC, where Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa came together. And recently they had a summit in Zanzibar, South Africa in August, where they said they're going to include Ethiopia, Egypt, Dubai, the United Arab Emirates, and Argentina in the beginning of this year, next month, January, which means that now you got 40% of the world's population inside of an organization outside of the World Bank, the IMF, and the IDA, which means now that the currencies become more multipolar instead of being unipolar, instead of being controlled by it. Because the trick of this is, just make a long story short, you got a situation where this U.S. dollar, which started in the U.S., was supposed to be based upon gold. It's based upon gold, silver, nickel, did I say silver? Yeah, copper. It's even in the U.S. Constitution that the currency must be based upon metals because of the tricks they saw happen in England when they fled England and went to the Indians' land, which they changed the name to America. But in 1969, when Richard Nixon was president, they had a whole lot of external debt, and they decided to take the dollar away from gold and have it based upon oil. Because at that time, the U.S. capitalists were controlling the oil of Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, various countries in the world. What does that mean? That means that before, when you had a dollar, if you had $20, you could go to any bank and say, give me $20 worth of gold. They have to give it to you. And at that time, an ounce of gold was like $20. So if you got a $20 bill, you get an ounce. But now, if you go to a bank and say, give me gold, they won't give it to you. They're not obliged to give it to you. But there's been a big difference in the price of the relationship between dollar and gold. In 1960, you could go buy a brand new sports car with 60 ounces of gold, which is less than $2,000. Now, in 2023, you can still buy a brand new sports car with 60 ounces of gold. But if you go with dollar, you have to go with $60,000. It's not because the price of gold went up, no, it's because the dollar falling like a rock. Which means that if you're a hard worker in any country where they use dollar, and you say, okay, every time I get some dollar, let me put it in the bank and save it for the future. You know, you're thinking, okay, if I save this money for 40, 50 years, when I get older and I retire from working, I can use use the money I got in this bank to live off of. But you didn't realize what happened was you're not saving money, you're losing money. In 1960, if you took that 60 ounces of gold and you hid the gold, you kept it in a safe place, you can take that gold now and sell it for, I think it's about $1,700 an ounce. You can check, but it's almost $2,000 an ounce since they hasn't reached that yet, which means that 60 ounces of gold will give you about $60,000 right now, which means if you save gold, you will make, you'll be living better. But you save the dollar, you'll be in big trouble. So the U.S. dollar's in trouble, the euro's in trouble, and you have China, which has been becoming stronger and stronger every year. They have more U.S. dollar in their reserves than the U.S. Treasury has in their reserves inside the U.S. So you got all these crises going on, and so it's only natural that when those who don't have any regards for humanity, for human life, they try to look for alternatives to make sure that they stay rich and get richer. So they make the situation more miserable for those who are living in particularly what we call the Africa, Asia, Latin American areas. Prices will increase whereas the price of labor will be decreased. You get paid less for working and you can buy fewer things with the money that you receive. They'll try to make sure that they shove a lot of loans down the throats of a country because they know that they eventually have to pay it back. You know, for example, there are many countries in the world, in Africa, Asia, Latin America, they're spending more on a monthly basis just paying back the service fees and the interest, not even paying back the main debt. They're spending more money on that. They spend on agriculture, education, and health so that a few people continue to get richer and richer. So you got these two different things going on at the same time. You got initiatives to have more of a multipolar world, and you got the crisis among the capitalists themselves. So you got that going, and then at the same time, you have the conscious level of the common person, the masses of people has been increasing. And as the consciousness increases, people take better action. So that explosion is being felt, not just in Africa, but we really feel it in Africa. It's going on in Latin America. It's going on in Asia as well. This is why you got wars going, like NATO fighting against Russia over Ukraine, trying to, you know, swallow Russia. We got the U.S. imperialists trying to all the time to provoke the People's Republic of China over the land of China called Taiwan. This is why you got war going on in Sudan, where you got thousands of people being killed. This is why the war has increased. It's intensified in occupied Palestine. This is why you got higher and higher levels of unemployment in places like where you live. You got more and more people sleeping on the streets because of this ongoing struggle to control the resources of the world. Now, how does that relate to Guinea-Bissau? Guinea-Bissau, during the time of Portuguese colonialism, Portugal was really kind of like a semi-colony of Britain. After World War II, Britain became pretty much a semi-colony of the U.S. The U.S. had the controls, the policies in Britain. It's the only country, at that time, it had 99% illiteracy rate, but it's the only country in West Africa where they had a tight-knit party, organized the people, and started a liberation movement with arms. The only country in West Africa that did a glorious armed struggle. Not only do a glorious armed struggle, gave priority to political education. Everywhere they would liberate a zone, they would put schools. And in these schools, they would put a revolutionary curriculum to teach equality of men and women. And those who were the best students in these schools were in the liberated lands, the liberated territories, were given scholarships to go study at the main school called the pilot school. Not the airplane pilot, but like a model school in Conakry, right next to the PIUC's national secretariat, where Amilcar Cabral worked and lived. He took a personal interest in these youth, understanding that they would be the future political cadre in the liberated Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. So when the children would go to schools in the liberated zones, when they got to the fifth grade, that's when they would choose the best to get the scholarships to go to Conakry. But with girls, they did positive discrimination. They didn't wait till you got to the fifth grade. When you get to the third grade, and then you even get a double, you skip the fourth grade, you go straight to the fifth grade to make sure that we make up for the many years of gender exploitation. They were learning about all of the world geography, history of the world, and had the opportunity to meet a lot of the world's leaders. Because Guinea Conakry at that time, it was called the People's Revolutionary Republic and Africanist Party, called the PDGRDA, the Democratic Party of Guinea of the African Democratic Revolution. And so this was a doorway for many revolutionary organizations to come to West Africa, in addition to the doorway in Accra, Ghana, at the time that the Convention People's Party was leading the government led by Asajj Kwame Nkrumah. But of course, after the coup d'etat in 1966 in Ghana, it was mainly Guinea Conakry. And that's where the PIDC had its base, its main secretariat, and that's where you had a number of other organizations also had their bases. Even the MPLA, way down in Angola, they had its office in Guinea Conakry. The Cameroon People's Organization, the United People of Cameroon, UPC, had their base there. So you had all these other revolutionary organizations in the world where the Revolutionary Party controlled the state, like the People's Workers' Party of the Democratic Republic of Korea, or like the Communist Party of the People's Democratic Democratic, the People's Republic of China. They had their embassies there. So you had all these different revolutionary organizations meet with the revolutionary diplomats. You had all that going on. So the PIC, once it obtained unilaterally took over the majority of the country, it decided to have elections. And it is elections inside the liberated zones and even some of the zones occupied by the enemy. First, they did the census and the people elected their own representatives. It wasn't the party that imposed representatives on them. In fact, of the 120 deputies that were elected to the first National People's Assembly, 40 came from the party, 80 just came from the general population. They were all democratically elected, and a large majority, 40% of them were women. This is why the war was still going on. The first task that it was given was to approve a constitution. After that, to vote on whether or not the people want to have independence. They want to have a republic again, themselves, an independent state. Of course, they voted for it unanimously. So this is very different than many places in the world, huh? If not all the countries of the world. Usually, you have one leader who say, okay, we proclaim independence. But with the Guinea-Bissau, no, it was the people's representative in the National People's Assembly, ANP, that proclaimed the existence of the state. Now, why is this very important for us? You had a serious transformation going on in Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde. One party, but two different states. The Republic of Cape Verde, the Republic of Guinea-Bissau, one party. And this one party had very good relationships with the other revolutionary parties in Africa and the world. The PDGRD that I mentioned getting Congress, almost like the twin sister of the PIGC. MPLA, even though it was a movement that later transformed to the party, it was actually co-founded by Amilcar Cabral, because Cabral already founded with other revolutionaries what was called the Partido Unido de Luta de Africanos Angola, United Party of the United Party of Struggle for the Africans in Angola. That's the party that came together with the Communist Party of Angola and the National Movement of Angola to form the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola, MPLA, which is still in power to now. And then coordinated struggle together with Frelimo, the Liberation Front of Mozambique. So you had all this going on by the PIGC, building a socialist society even before they proclaimed independence. We just used trade. Nobody used the Portuguese money. Nobody used dollar. Used trade. So as a result of this going on, when the party took over the whole state, the party state, the PIGC controlling Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, they were using that to transform the society as well as the other parts of Africa, like you mentioned earlier. They understood very well the independence of Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde is meaningless unless it's linked to the total liberation, unification of Africa with socialism. So they began to help MPLA get its independence from Portuguese colonialism. They began to help other parts of Africa struggle against the apartheid regime in South Africa and even outside Africa. Help the Palestinians in their struggle against Zionism in occupied Palestine. Help Fretlin, the Liberation Front for Timor-Leste, what some people call East Timor. Very close relationships with Cuba. In fact, many people might know that Cuba, when the racist regime of the apartheid regime of South Africa invaded Angola, you had a lot of Cuban troops that went to Angola to help the MPLA. Well, all of those troops that came from Cuba would come to Guinea-Bissau first in airport, and that's where they go to Angola. In fact, the PIC helped them get some of their weapons. Even right now, I understand we still have a debt with the former Soviet Union of some arms that we borrowed from them to help our comrades in the MPLA. So, of course, the enemy, seeing all this going on, seeing the factories open up, factories that instead of us having to import goods, we're making them ourselves, making our own preserves, making our own beds, making our own clothes, even assembly cars. We had a car assembly factory here, right down the street from where I live. So the enemy understood that at the rate the Guinea-Bissau is going, it won't be long. They will have 100% literacy, right? They have factories for every aspect of the people's needs. They're giving all the support to these liberation movements. So the enemy will be in trouble. Because going back to what I said earlier, the only reason that Europe is able to feed most of its people right now is because they've been exploiting us in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. In other words, the relative level of development of Europe depends on the underdevelopment of Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And likewise, they understand the more that Africa, Asia, and Latin America develop, the more underdeveloped they become because they depend on our resources. So they had to do anything and everything they could to try to slow this process up or even try to stop it. One of the main weapons that they use is traders. In our country, Guinea-Bissau, in 1980, just 6 years after the party took over the state apparatus, a coup happened. The person who did the coup was a well-known war hero, but he doesn't have the party in his consciousness, in his heart. So he did the coup to try to get rid of the PIGC, but because of the relative strength of the PIGC, he was able to fight back. So he at least had to say, okay, I'm just doing an adjustment movement inside the PIGC. But he took over just about everything. Took over the National People's Assembly, suspended it, and created a council called the Revolutionary Council. Revolutionary Council. Suspended the Constitution. Well, we used to have the collective organ we had called the Council of State. Now it became just like an advisory body to him. And then he started to eliminate some of those people who were closer to him. But make a long story short, he ended up bringing these types of reactionary reforms to take us away from the centralized planned economy that socialism requires to have a free market enterprise and eventually multipartyism. But the revolutionary citizens of the party continued to work to make sure that we kept the party intact and the struggle against him, little by little. Of course, you know, people lost their lives along the way, but eventually he was defeated, he was killed, and the party stopped becoming stronger. So now the collective imperialists in West Africa begin to use, again, some of the countries of West Africa they control, like our neighboring country, Senegal, steal our fish to try to steal, you know, our natural resource and destabilize our country. So coming up to the province of today, I'm going to start 3 years ago. In 2019...
Just before we go to the problems of today, I just want you to dig a little bit deeper into the strength of the PAGC. And maybe the question that I would like to ask is, to what will you attribute the strength of the PAGC going on from the days it was founded, such that it is still strong, working for the masses, working for the people, working for the interest of the people and in Guinea-Bissau and for the interest of Africans? Because a lot of liberation movements, you know, seem to have staggered over the years, and they seem to have been compromised. Certain elements, as we have said, seem to have crept in who have no interest of the people, but who are selfish and who are using the movement to serve their own individual selfish ends. Please talk to us about, to what exactly will you attribute the strength of the PAGC in over the years, able to stand so much against it? Because when you go back, you realize that NATO supported the Portuguese against the people, but the people still won against these all forces. So there must be something underlying the organization of the PAGC and its, you know, survival up to this day.
Thank you very much for this question, because maybe I was going too fast and didn't remember to point out a fundamental fact. The fact is, it's the party that's the guarantee of the revolution, no matter where you are. If you're in Cuba, it's the Communist Party of Cuba that's the guarantee of the Cuban Revolution. In Guinea-Bissau, it's the PAGC. So one of the, I think that what the world could learn from the PAGC is that it made a political decision that instead of being just a vanguard party, it would be a mass party where the vanguard would lead the party. That's to say, a vanguard party takes the best children of the land and they lead the people. Whereas the mass party said, let's bring everybody from the land into the party and then take the vanguard, the best of those, to be in the best, to be in the leadership position of their party. So they made the decision to have it be a mass party, not just be a vanguard party. That's to say, in the villages. I know there are a lot of people who are revolutionary. They go into the village, they see everybody's illiterate, and they see some backwards practices. They see a village that's dominated by mysticism. Then they probably said, okay, let's leave this village. Not the PIGC. They said, we're going to organize the village. And inside this village, we're going to put a structure where the people themselves will be the ones who lead the structure. But out of the five positions in this space structure, at least two have to be a woman. And you know, in some of our societies that have been contaminated by colonialism and other backwards influences, some people didn't want to see a sister, a woman in a leadership position. The party said, if you don't put the sister in leadership position, you won't have the party here. So that made a big difference. Second thing, giving priority to education. Cabral said, when we just started fighting the armed phase of the struggle in 1963, but there were a lot of backwards practices and deviations that were going inside of some of the responsibles of the party who were leading the armed struggle. So Cabral called for a Congress, and in the Congress, those people were disciplined. Some were killed. Others were demoted. Others were put in prison. But it was at that same Congress that the party decided we're going to have schools everywhere we liberate, and then we're going to put schools. Now, some people say, but schools, we're fighting. You got bombs falling on people. You got missiles. You got helicopters, jets bombing us with napalm and all types of different weapons. How you going to put schools? You going to put the troops? But I say, if you don't put schools, it's worthless. It's not worthwhile to liberate the area. So you have these teachers who are teaching because of the love of our people. And then Cabral also, you know, being taking a personal interest. And some of the party leaders were also teaching. So that's one aspect. The other aspect is that Cabral had the opportunity to learn from mistakes of other areas. He was there in Guinea-Conakry. We had a lot of visitors coming all the time. But yeah, all the time with the Ghana when Nkrumah was still in power. And then after Nkrumah was a victim of a reactionary coup d'etat in 1966, Nkrumah came to Guinea-Conakry and became the co-president of the People's Democratic Republic of Guinea. So Cabral used to be at his house, Villa Silly, all the time. And Nkrumah sometimes would go visit the PIC base. Cabral had the opportunity to learn from some of the mistakes that happened in Ghana. For example, he noted that Nkrumah used to make this criticism himself. Nkrumah realized in 1960 he didn't have enough of a political education going on among the responsibles in the state, which is why he said, okay, let's organize an ideological school in a place called Winneba in Ghana. But 6 years later, it was overturned. In our opinion, the political education didn't really get to the base of the party. So I think the Guinea-Conakry, led by the PDG, led by Sekou Touré, they learned from their era. Because I'm sure Cabral Nkrumah was also, you know, this is one of the mistakes he made. So he tried to do the same thing there. And he tried to correct that era in Guinea-Conakry to make sure that the base of the PDG RDA became stronger. They put what they called the party base, PRL, the Revolutionary Authority, the People's Revolutionary revolutionary local authority, the revolutionary people's authority in the local area. Pouvoir revolutionnaire local. Local revolutionary power. Revolutionary local power. To bring together the party and the state. So in Guinea-Conakry, with the PRA at the base of the party, every Friday afternoon, after prayers, the schools would be out of session. There was no discotheques, no work. Everybody just called a meeting all over the country where you get political education. And also had people's militia. So Cabral learned from this. He was able to go to Senegal several times, so he saw how neo-colonial society worked. He lived in Guinea-Conakry, how a revolutionary society worked. He used to go to Ghana all the time, so he saw how that revolutionary society worked. And then Nkrumah, after the coup d'etat, lived in Guinea-Conakry as the president for 6 years before he made his transition. So there had a lot of exchanges there. Of course, he was able to go to places like Congo after Lumumba was assassinated. He was able to go to even the capitalist countries, France, England, U.S., for visits. So he was able to have in China, the Soviet Union. So he had this global vision of what are the revolutionary societies, the counter-revolutionary society, or that's to say the capitalist-controlled society. So he was able to adapt the party to those realities. Not to import the revolution, but to import some universal aspects. So the second thing that I think really contributed to was everywhere you had an armed commander of a front, you would also have a political commissar who paid more importance than that armed commander. Third thing that I think made a big difference also was actually the pedagogy of Amilcar Cabral. Cabral was able to take complex terms and break them down to very simple terms so that everybody can understand. Fourth aspect, I think, is after independence too, the schools. The schools became almost like in Guinea-Conakry. In Guinea-Conakry, they called them the revolutionary teaching centers. Okay, we'll just call them schools. So the same thing. You would organize the youth. If it's the kindergarten, the first grade up to the fourth grade, in the primary schools, you have pioneers. And so each classroom, the children would elect who would be their leadership, who would be the responsible for the classroom, who would be responsible for health and hygiene, who would be responsible for sports, culture, recreation, who would be responsible for information, and who would be those different responsibilities. And the director of the school would be a youth from the youth wing. The youth wing is called the Amilcar Cabral African Youth. So after school, during the school, the children are being taught with some revolutionary terms, based upon science. After school, they have after school activities, how to march together, how to hold the meeting together. And then some of the best will be selected every year to go for an international camp with other pioneers from other revolutionary organizations. The youth organization was the one that controlled the high schools, and they considered to be the combatant reserve of the party. And they did a lot of political education with it as well. So with these youth who became the directors of the schools, the teachers of the schools, and they used to have a course they called political training from the fifth grade on up, where you would learn about materialism, dialectical materialism, historical materialism, philosophical materialism. You learn about cause and effect. You learn about geography. You learn about the history of the party, of the country, and the other parties in the world. They have the whole lot. And then the radio, you only had one radio station. Radio station had a special program about Amilcar Cabral, about his ideas. Another program that the women controlled through the women's organization called the Democratic Union of Guinean Women, UDIMU. He had a youth program organized by Jacques. He had another children's program organized by the pioneers of the party, which is named after Amilcar Cabral's African name, Abel Jassy. They call it the Organization of Pioneers of Abel Jassy. And then too, I'm having a lot of exchange with other revolutionary youth and children. You have to hold out to really make sure that the ideas planted. But I think one of the main things that probably made a difference too, though, you had a party leading the armed struggle. You know, if you look at the countries around the area where you grew up in, Southern Africa, the armed struggle in Angola was led by a movement, the Popular Movement for the Liberation of Angola. To the eastern part, you got Mozambique. It was also led by a front, the Front for the Liberation of Mozambique, Frelimo. Even in Zimbabwe, it really wasn't a party. You had ZAPO, the Zimbabwe African People's Organization. You also had the ZANU, Zimbabwe African National Union. But with Guinea-Bissau, you had a party. Why does that make a big difference? In a front, you bring together anybody, individual, organization that has the same enemy. Okay, we're all against, for example, ZANU is a front. Okay, or Mozambique, you have Frelimo as a front. Anybody who's against Portuguese colonialism, come on, let's fight. And the movements, like the Popular Movement for Liberation in Angola, MPLA. Anybody that's willing to, that's against Portuguese colonialism, come on, let's fight this movement. We got the same enemy, but you don't have the same ideas. You don't have the same philosophy. Why does that make a big difference? If you talk to any militant of the PIGC and ask them, what are you against? They can tell you. If you ask them, what are you for? They will tell you. But on the other hand, if you call together the average militant, even some of the leaders of the Front, the Frelimo Front in Mozambique, the MPLA movement in Angola, they could all tell you they got the same enemy. Portuguese colonialists, oh yes, what are you for? You got a different response. They're all against the same thing, but they're not all in favor of the same thing. That also make a big difference. I think also another big difference, too, to be honest with you, was the fact that collectively you had a number of responsibles in addition to Amilcar Cabral, who were able to learn a lot from the revolution going on in Guinea-Conakry, led by Sekou Touré. Sekou Touré is very honest, courageous, cultured person, has a high level of responsibility. And Nkrumah, very honest, high level of culture, responsible. So you had this atmosphere, this climate, this ambience that was created, I think, particularly in West Africa. Not just West, but particularly in West Africa in this case. So by the fact that it's the only party that led an armed struggle in West Africa, it had a big difference too, because can you imagine at the age of 19 or 18 or 20, you went through, you have this love for your people, you have hatred for the enemy of your people, but you go through some military training, you get political education, and you're given a weapon where you can shoot down a jet. Now that's power, huh? You know, like right now, we see our people being exploited by racists in New Mexico or Utah or in England. You know, we have a little protest, but you got a weapon, one is called the Strela, that can shoot down, you give me the responsibility to protect a community of about 2,000 people against enemy airplanes, and you got a gun to defend these people. You got this high level responsibility, you're only 20 years old. And then you have this mixing going on among revolutionaries, because you know, you had this glorious armed struggle that happened in Algeria. Well, the people of Algeria from 1954 to 1962 defeated the French, but they defeated the French at a high price. Some people say 1,500,000 Africans in Algeria became martyrs. That is that they were killed during this struggle against the French. And Algeria opened up its door. Cabral used to go there all the time. He called it the Mecca of the Revolution. He got a number of our combatants, our freedom fighters, who were either trained in Algeria or Algerians came to Guinea-Conakry and trained them there. And then in Egypt, it was a revolutionary society during the time of Gabriel Nasser from 1954 up to 1976 when he made his transition. We had some interaction there. Then you have a lot of our freedom fighters trained in Cuba, and then a lot of our children went to school in Cuba. Same thing with the Soviet Union, with China. That's to say, just about all the socialist countries, Yugoslavia, Czechoslovakia, our youth went to school there. So he came back with all these revolutionary ideas, like a revolutionary salad, exchanging ideas among each other. He got an organization in place to do that. I think that's what really contributed to our culture. I believe that what Cabral said about culture is very, very relevant. He said there are different manifestations of culture, but if you want to look for the politically organized manifestation of a people's culture, it's in the liberation movement. So that is to say, the PIGC is not just a political party, no. It's a part of our culture. It's our people's culture organized politically. And you know how strong culture is. Culture gives you courage, gives you energy, culture. So I think that these facts, in my opinion, are what really contribute to the PIGC. We never go through so much because we've gone through betrayals, we've gone through attacks. And right now, we're going through it again. In 1920, really at the end of 2019, we had presidential elections. And the PIGC candidate won 40% of the votes against, I think it was 11 different candidates. During the runoff election, you know, they did a lot of irregularities. They bought off, they tried to buy off the Supreme Court. They weren't successful, but they bought off the National Electoral Council. And when I say they, I'm talking about the French imperialists. We could say imperialists in general, but in this case, the French imperialists, who were really using Senegal. Because the president of Senegal is nothing but a flunky of French imperialists. Right now, it's Macky Sall. I'm sure after he leaves, if we're not able to get a revolutionary president, there'll be another flunky of French imperialism. So they were able to do a lot of irregularities, but the Supreme Court, fortunately, said that you have to go back and recount the votes because there've been a lot of irregularities at the level of the voting booths. It never happened up to this day. Instead, what happened was the traitor president used the so-called presidential guard to go secure a hotel and illegally give the votes to the contender in this election, whose name is Umaro Sissoko Embalo. He is a hustler, a neocolonialist puppet. He's somebody who's very close to Blaise Compaoré, the president of Burkina Faso, who did the coup, who killed Thomas Sankara and did the coup against him, and who did it for France. It was through Herbert Félix Boigny of Cote d'Ivoire, a big French puppet, who used Blaise Compaoré to bring about a coup in Burkina Faso. And so this became like the older brother, Umaro Sissoko Embalo. So he's been working with all these other French puppets, Denis Sassou Nguesso, Macky Sall, to be used to Guinea-Bissau. So he was imposed as the president in February 2020, right before we went to the lockdown because of coronavirus. So for us, coronavirus became corona beatings. You go outside, you get beat. And they were able to consolidate temporarily their victory, their coup, and begin to mislead the country, sacking the treasury. Just to give you an example, he's one of the highest paid presidents in the world, whereas Guinea-Bissau is one of the poorest countries in the world. every time he, in addition to his salary being so high, every time he travels, if he just decides to travel for one day, automatically he gets 25 million French stefas. But he has an allowance every day, which is 750,000 French stefas every day. And he travels like 4 or 5 times a week. And he has these airplanes to come here. We don't know what they're bringing and what they're taking out. But of course, you know, the observers say they're bringing in drugs and arms. He's using that to sell to other places. But one thing is for sure, he flies around in this very luxury private jet. I mean, super luxury. According to information that's been received from the Ministry of Finances, he pays 8,000 euro per hour. It means if he travels for 3 hours, he pays 24,000 euro. So he violated the Constitution every single way he could and publicly declared he's going to get rid of the PIA. He's going to destroy the PIA. Now, I forgot to mention to you that when the coup happened in 1980, the same PIA, the city-controlled Guinea-Bissau and Cape Verde, was supposed to have his Congress in Cape Verde in January of 1981. But the coup happened 3 months before, in November 1980. So the branch of the PIC in Cape Verde decided to go in with the Congress without those from Guinea-Bissau, since we had a coup. And they decided to start an organization called the PASEV. Instead of the African Party of Independence of Guinea-Cape Verde, the African Party of Independence of Cape Verde, PAICV. Some of the PIC leaders who were victimized by the coup, they stayed there to work with them. And when this man, this French puppet, this mercenary, Umaru Sissoko Embalo, he went to Cape Verde when he first took power here. He told the people in Cape Verde probably, he said, why don't y'all get rid of this PICV? He said, we're going to get rid of the PIC and get yourself, so you get rid of the PICV in Cape Verde. This is how crazy it is. I told you that the party is the politically organized manifestation of our culture. You can probably get rid of the sun, the moon, and the sky before you get rid of this party. Even if you kill everybody in Guinea-Bissau, you can't get rid of the party. We got militants outside of Guinea-Bissau. Even if you were able to, even if they had some kind of virus that only attacked people born in Guinea-Bissau, you know, even if your grandfather was born in Portugal or U.S. and you were born there, and you're killed by this virus that only attacks descendants of Guinea-Bissau, can't get rid of PIC. We got people all over the world who, independent of where they're born, they're PIC as well. So make a long story short, this is how crazy they think they're going to get rid of this PIC. So he did everything he could do. Attack our party headquarters several times. Sometime we're in a meeting, they just start shooting these grenades of tear gas from Zionist Israel, attacking our militants, feeding our militants, imprisoning our militants. The radio stations that are close to us, attacking them in broad daylight with guns, machine guns, to destroy their radios, just violating the Constitution left and right. So, for example, last year, in the month of May, he decided to dissolve the National People's Assembly. Now, according to the Constitution, if you dissolve the National People's Assembly, you have to have legislative elections no later than 90 days. That's about 3 months. He didn't even set a date at all. It happened in May, right? You dissolve the National Assembly in May. You're supposed to have the election no later than August. But he didn't say anything. Finally, around the end of August, he said, okay, we're going to have an election in December. They didn't do anything to prepare for the election. They got all these and then he set a way to call it a presidential initiative government. We don't have that in our Constitution. Our Constitution is one of the better constitutions in the world. It has calls for decentralization of authority, separation of powers, and it has what we call a semi-presidential regime. That is to say, in a presidential regime, like in the U.S., or in Zaire, South Africa, or Swaziland, or in Senegal, or Nigeria, you elect a president, the president appoints the members of the government, the cabinet. Okay, this person's going to be the Minister of Health, the Minister of Education, or in some system they call it, the United States they call it Secretary of State for Health Education, Secretary of State for Commerce, Secretary of State for like that. Not here. It's the parties that vote for elections. So the parties are a coalition of parties that wins the absolute majority. It's the party or coalition that will form a government. Irregardless of whether or not the president likes it or not, he or she is obligated to appoint that party. So it's the party will tell you, okay, for example, with us in the PIDC, in our statutes, we say that whenever we win legislative elections, the president of our party is our first candidate to become the prime minister. But we can also choose one of the vice presidents if we want to. So once we choose that person, whether you like it or not, you have to appoint that person to be the prime minister. And that prime minister, for his or her part, will turn around and nominate the different members of the government. The Minister for Health, the Minister of Education, Minister for Transportation, Commerce, etc., Foreign Affairs, etc. So they didn't do any of that. They didn't prepare anything for the December election. So, of course, it didn't happen. 2 days before the date was supposed to happen, he said, okay, well, you're not ready for election, so we're going to do it in June. And again, now, without calling the parties to get their opinion, unilaterally said, okay, this one. And he still wants to change the Constitution to take us away from the semi-presidential regime to go to be a presidential regime. So while we got all the struggles going on, we still make sure that we do political education. We make sure that we have the party school still functioning and make sure that, you know, it's really, to be honest with you, it's very difficult to keep all the bases functioning with all the distractions going on. First of all, you have some people who don't think that, they think that you have more influence, you have more more credibility when you're leader of the party. But when you go down to the base, you know, that's just for the ordinary people. So, you know, for them, that's not prestigious to be down there. Whereas us revolutionaries, we look at the just the opposite. We say it's the base of the party. It's the top of the party where the people are. You don't go down to the people. You go up to the people. So we have some of those struggles going on. You have other struggles going on where, you know, you have some people at the level of the base who maybe because of the relative lack of constant political education, sometimes they will put the more social aspect, more propriety to the political aspect. You know, I'm spending a lot of time, okay, one of our members' mother died, let's go to the funeral. Or this, you know, this one had a baby, let's go to the baby shower. This one's going to get married, let's go to the wedding, which is important. But sometimes some of them will give more importance to those social aspects than the political aspect. And others want to, in my opinion, instead of taking it just to study on their own, somebody to come and say, okay, study this, and actually give them a summary of what they're studying. So those struggles going on, which is natural. And, you know, of course, you got a lot of people who, you know, they have a serious challenge just to live every single day. You have families, many, I think the overwhelming majority of families, in fact, well, maybe they might get 4 o'clock in the morning, 5 o'clock in the morning to either drive public transportation, taxi, or those tro-tro vans to make enough money to have food to eat in the house. You got a lot of those who go to the, where they sell fish, to buy fish, to resell in the markets, to get enough money so they can eat for the day. So you spend all day working, selling fish or selling vegetables and fruits, or driving a car or a truck. You don't have much time for political education. So those are some of the challenges we were facing. And so you have that coupled with the fact you had a repressive regime who's openly with the imperialists, openly with the Zionists of occupied Palestine, openly with the imperialist president of France, Emmanuel Macron. You know, you got him. So you have some people say, okay, we got to organize. You have other people say, oh, maybe that's just how life is. You know, he's stronger than us. But our party kept organized using that collective consciousness that came throughout the years. But we still have some people who are alive who were together with Cabral, a number of them. And then we have a lot of the children whose parents were freedom fighters because it was a mass struggle, a mass armed struggle. Make a long story short, we got to the point where even with all of the manipulation of the National Electoral Council, the manipulation of the voter registration process, all of the cheating, and then the disproportion of resources. I mean, they had millions and millions of euros, millions and millions of dollars, all types of cars and trucks and sound equipment, and all types of propaganda posters, billboards, banners, t-shirts. They had all these little really different groups of support. Whereas on our part, we don't have to have any propaganda at all. We don't have to have any money at all. And the little propaganda we were able to produce, they blocked it from coming in. So we had to do a what was called an electoral campaign without having all these t-shirts, without having all these banners, without having these posters, and having even logistics. We only had one sound truck that we rented. Some of our comrades went to Gambia and rented a very old used sound truck. And every used about 3 or 4 hours, it breaks down on you. That's all we had. But my brothers and sisters, comrades, you should see the way the masses welled up the street when everybody see one of the PIC leaders come, particularly the president of the PIC. The mass of the people took ownership of the process. So it's the masses of the people, particularly among our youth, who sat at the tables as monitors for our party. But then we had a lot of people around each table where people were voting. You had the neighbors of that table who woke up early in the morning to make sure nobody did any cheating. And also to make sure that those who were representing the PIC had food to eat and water to drink so they could be alert. And then with our system, when you count the votes, it's a manual process. When you empty out the voting booth, everybody has to count all the votes. Everybody's the winner when they count all the votes. What's the total number of votes? So then when they begin to count, okay, PIGC and this coalition, PIE, Tedaronka got one, this other one got one, this other one got one. When they count up all the votes publicly, they have a little form. They fill out, okay, they have to put the results of each of the parties, they have to post that publicly by the voting tape. People took pictures of that with their Android phones and sent it to social media. But even still, they tried to cheat. Because, I mean, they were shocked when they came to find out they only got 24% of the vote. The president of Senegal, Macky Sall, even came here and tried to get some of the other political parties on band with him so they could change the results of the election. Didn't work. So they're in that state of shock still now. And as a result of all of that, what ended up happening was when they were not able to change the results, even though I tell you that all of the cheating they did with the voter registration, all the cheating they did on election day, all the disproportionate use of resource, they still were only able to get 24% of the vote. And this current illegal imposed president, Umar Sissoko Mbalo, had his picture on all of the propaganda of this movement called MADEM, M-A-D-E-M. They call it G-15, which means that this election was really like a pre-presidential election for him. Because, you know, to win president, you have to have a party supporting you. So now the party supporting you with all these resources, all the cheating you did, this illegal presidential initiative, so-called government, still only get 24%. vote, this other vote. He already knows he's already lost the election. So some of them died from heart attacks. Some of them, you know, are still permanently deranged. Others fled. But they had to, you know, try something desperate. We have a saying in Guinea-Bissau. If you don't know how to swim and you're in the deep ocean, in the high ocean, and the boat capsizes or the ship sinks, you don't know how to swim. Even if you see a little bitty piece of plastic like this floating by, then let me grab that to save my life. It won't save your life. So that's what they did on the 30th of November, on the 1st of December. They decided to do a desperate initiative. They said that they accused the Minister of Economy and Finance and the state treasurer of making an illegal financial operation. So the public ministry, by law, can call them and ask them questions and ask for their documents. But by law, they cannot arrest them. But he arrested them. When he arrested them, some people with uniforms from the National Guard, when they took them out of prison and took them to the National Guard headquarters. This is the information we have. A few hours later, you had these militia from the presidency, whose job it is to protect the presidency and the president. Now, the president's outside the country, and they come all the way from the presidency over to the National Guard headquarters and start shooting. And I also want to point out that this National Guard headquarters is very close to the house of the president of the National People's Assembly, who is the same brother and comrade who's the president of the PIGC. Domingo Simoes Pereira. So in our system, with our semi-presidential regime, it's the president of the National People's Assembly that serves as the substitute to the president. So the president is outside the country, which means that Domingo Simoes Pereira was the acting president. But they didn't even tell him they were going to shoot. They did all the shooting. You know, of course, you had two deaths. You had different numbers. Sometimes some people said 12. But the official figures, there were two deaths. So they took the Minister of Economy and Finance and the state treasurer back to the prison, to the cell. According to our law, when a person is accused of violating a law, stealing, it's only the judge can decide to put them in preventive detention. But they kept them in preventive detention for more. And even when the judge said, you can only be there for more than 3 days. You have to have a case after a trial. They've been in there ever since the 30th of November. Today is the 17th of December. That's more than 2 weeks, almost 3 weeks. So then they tried to use this to smear the image of the PIGC and the president of the National People's Assembly, who's also president of the PIGC party. So I mentioned to you that this imposed president, Umaru Sissoko Embalo, was outside of the country when this happened. So he comes back into the country on the 2nd. Looks like he's high on something, you know, all like this. They tried to do a coup against me while I was out of the country. And I'm almost sure that the President of the National Assembly had something to do with this. That was his first thing. And I'm going to dissolve the National People's Assembly. So the next day, he gets these different interviews and keeps on, you know, pointing out that the President of the National People's Assembly was involved with this. Why? Because he knows that if we have elections today, we won't have a second vote. On the first round, the brother comrade who's the president of the National People's Assembly, Domingo Simoes Pereira, win an overwhelming majority on the first vote. I'm telling you, his party got 24% of the vote in June. But they've been dwindling it down since then, because even some of the leadership of the party has come out against them. Talk about how undemocratic they are and how they've been stealing money, that type of thing. So this is his desperate attempt. I want to point out to you that with our system, when you have legislative elections, for the first 12 months, you cannot touch the National People's Assembly, no matter what the crisis is. It's only logical. Because if you have legislative elections in June, the person who the president is doesn't like the results of the election, you can just dissolve the National People's Assembly. That's why when they wrote the Constitution, they said for 1 year, you cannot dissolve it. Now, if the elections happen more than a year ago, which they didn't happen in June, then what has to happen is, if there's a serious crisis among the different institutions, the president of the republic has to call the president of the National Assembly, first of all, to meet. Then after that meeting, he or she has to call each party or political formation that has representation inside the National People's Assembly. Then after that, call for a meeting of the Council of State. Then after that, they can take a decision, dissolve or not dissolve. If the decision is to dissolve the National People's Assembly, we have a structure called the Permanent Commission of the National People's Assembly. Just like the word permanent says, it's a commission that's permanent. Even when the National People's Assembly is dissolved, those 15 elected responsibles take care of the day-to-day business of the National People's Assembly until you have an election, until they're replaced. But what did this one do? Out of all his craziness and desperateness, he sent some armed militia with masks on to surround the building of the National People's Assembly. When the president of the National People's Assembly said, we have suspended the session, the day that he made this declaration that the National People's Assembly is dissolved, he said it right away. The president said right away. The president of the National People's Assembly, the meeting was still going. He said he cannot dissolve this assembly. The assembly cannot be dissolved for 12 months after the election, but we'll suspend the session for today. Because some deputies said, okay, we need to have a meeting among our our caucus to discuss the situation. Okay, we'll suspend the session. And he put the date the 13th, few days. When the elective representatives of the people went to go to the People's House, the National People's Assembly, to have a meeting, you had these armed thugs shoot them with tear gas in broad daylight. Secondly, this imposed president, Umar Sissoko Embalo, on the 1st of February last year, there was an alleged attempted coup d'etat, which most people don't believe it had been a, don't believe that it was an attempted coup d'etat. It was staged. They used that as a condition to have ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African State, send in an armed brigade, 700 soldiers, armed soldiers, mainly from Senegal. After that, Nigeria. You got a few from that, from Ghana. But those are the only really countries they have, mainly Senegal and Nigeria, but mainly Senegal, to protect all the institutions, which means that you're supposed to have some of them for the president, some for the president, National People's Assembly, some for the prime minister, and then some for the different ministries. And that's an order from ECOWAS. But Umaru Sissoko Embalo, when he came back from traveling, he sent a message to the armed regime, the armed, what they call the stabilization mission of Guinea-Bissau from ECOWAS, that they should remove the two armed guards for the president of the National People's Assembly. Then he sent a note to the Secretary of State for Public Order and said that the bodyguards to the president of the National People's in 2014 should be removed. So the question is why? Why does he want to remove the security from the president of the National Assembly? The rules and regulation of the National People's Assembly says that whoever is the president of the National People's Assembly has the right to have escorts and bodyguards. And it's only the president of the National Assembly to control, to manage those bodyguards. Nobody else. So how can you have, even if he was an elected, democratically elected president of the country, how can he now go over the, I can't interfere with the National People's Assembly. Again, I want to remind our viewers that the National People's Assembly is the superior structure of our country because it's the people's body. It's the people who elected our representatives to sit into the People's House, what we call the National People's Assembly, to make laws for our country, to make a constitution for our country. So we have separation of powers. The president cannot interfere. The Supreme Court cannot interfere with the National People's Assembly. Just like it's the National People's Assembly that gives, it inaugurates the president. It's from the National People's Assembly the government comes from. So, make a long story short, they're prohibited us from having marches when he made the decision to supposedly dissolve the National People's Assembly. Of course, our people rose up. So when we rose up, they would attack us. Even the youth, the Mekong African youth, who went to the headquarters of ECOWAS. They said, ECOWAS, okay, how can you be so quiet? You have to make some noise. You have to be involved. This president is violating the Constitution, trying to dissolve a National People's Assembly. We cannot be dissolved. They beat some of those youth and arrested the rest. So they're trying to instill fear in the society, rest of people. Why? Because that gang of imperialists, in this case led by the French imperialists, they consider the PIGC to be the biggest threat for them, stopping them from squandering our resources. Not just got a lot of petroleum, they're going to start exploiting the petroleum for the first time after all many years of studies in May. We got large deposits of bauxite in the eastern part of the country. We got large deposits of phosphate in the northern part. We got 100 something different minerals, many of which are strategic. We got billions and billions of arrows or dollars worth of fish in our seas, different types of species. We got petroleum in our seas. And then I told you we got one of the deepest ports in all of Africa, third deepest port, which itself is worth more than all the gold and diamonds we have all together. They want to control that because they're in trouble. You already know that there have been a lot of initiatives by the mass of our people throughout Africa, but particularly West Africa against French imperialists. Senegal, all the uprisings that happened last year and early this year, the target was French establishment. And a lot of those who did the uprisings are in jail right now, others are dead. Other than torture. If you look at Guinea-Conakry to the west of us, we have a border with them. And there's a military regime that's ruling right now. To the north of Guinea-Conakry, you got Mali. To the west, to the east of that, you got Burkina Faso. East of that, you got Niger. Burkina Faso, Niger, and Burkina Faso, and Mali, and Niger have kicked the French out of most parts. You still got some left in Niger. But for the most part, in Mali, they've kicked them all out. They established their own bank, a central bank for the three states. They're making a confederation, which means that now the French won't get money from the French CFA. French CFA is a currency that was designed during the time of French colonialism. They used to call it the franc of the French colonies in Africa. That's what the CFA means. Colonials Francis African. After sham independence, they changed the C from colonial to be community. So it's the franc for the French communities of Africa, which means that each of those countries have to keep large deposits of foreign currency inside of the French treasury. And every time you make serious transactions, significant transactions on an international basis, a percentage goes to the French treasury. And you have to give France the priority for exploitation of resources before you open up for other countries. got a whole bunch of attachments to it. In addition to the taking over our resources again, for example, Burkina Faso now they have they're building, which means that they'll get more profit from their gold, and France will get less. In Niger, for example, this is one example. Got a lot of uranium there. The French used to exploit that dirt cheap, less than I think about 25 US dollar, 25 cent of a US dollar for each kilo. But now they put the price. I think it's like $25 now, something like that. So you know the economies are really. Economies of Niger, Burkina Faso, they're having hardship because of the closing of the borders, because of sabotage. But the economy is developing very quickly now as a result of this, which means that France is losing from that because it's not theirs in the first place, but they consider it to be theirs because they call it their community. So that has a whole lot of, it has a serious impact on Guinea-Bissau. Because again, now Guinea-Bissau, again, going back to what I said earlier, it's the only country in West Africa where you had the mass of people organized, pick up a gun, and as you mentioned, not only defeat Portuguese colonies, but NATO. There were U.S. jets. Guns and French guns and West Germany guns, grenades, and Italian guns, grenades that were used against our people in England, Spain, all of that. All those NATO countries came together, and our people whipped them. These people who you say were 99% illiterate, and they didn't walk around bare feet, eating once a day, they beat them. So it gave the example that when the people organize, you can defeat what is considered to be even the strongest enemy. So make a long story short, comrade, our people are giving an example, and we're going to defeat them again, too. Because there's no way in the world that an autocratic, crazy, even if he was democratically elected, which he once wasn't, he cannot dissolve the National People's Assembly, especially 12 months and within 12 months after the election. It's just, you know, that you have these institutions like ECOWAS, the Economic Union of West African States, which is delegated authority from the African Union. You know, I think they're not in a hurry. Depends on who's in the different departments. For example, you have what they call the Security Commissioner, ECOWAS. If you got some more serious type of technicians who are somewhat politically conscious in that commission, they'll move a little fast. But then they have to report to the Council of Ministers, foreign ministers, and the heads of state. And that's when you get things get slowed down. But even after all that, this last week, on the 11th of December, they held the summit of the heads of state after the foreign ministers met, after the security committee said that we're going to invite the president to reopen up the national people. And we're going to invite him also to now get rid of this armed stabilization mission, literally little by little. That's what they said. And he said the only government that should be worked with is the government led by Gerardo Martins, who is the prime minister for the PIA Tararanka, PIA coalition. By the time it got to the heads of state, you know, they kind of watered it down a little bit, but it was enough to make the self-imposed president really mad. He got up and stormed out of the room before they finished reading the resolution. He came back here and then told a whole bunch of untruths, a whole bunch of lies about what was said there. But people know how to read. Some people just got the finer communiques, which you can get also from ECOWAS thing, ECOWAS.int. So in a few days, I'm sure that they'll send a mission here. It's okay, you got to open up this National People's Assembly. Meanwhile, this can make our party more even more mature, and the mass of people have more confidence in us. But right now, you know, you have some people kind of like this, you know, when's it going to happen? Like today, just to go out exercise, took me a whole lot of time because, you know, a lot of people have confidence in me, so they want to know my opinion. So I spend more time giving my opinion than I did exercise.
Yeah, it seems like there's a lot to talk about in that West Africa, and I wish we can reschedule to speak more in depth about the politics there in West Africa and the AU. But I want us to conclude with probably a final word from you. There is so much that you have shared, and I wish we can have 5 hours. I will have gone back to some of the talking points. There is so much to talk about for sure. The last point that I want you to talk to, Amilcar Cabral, immediately after the death of Kwame Nkrumah, he gave a speech which was homage to Kwame Nkrumah. He spoke about that Kwame Nkrumah did not necessarily die of the physical cancer, in a sense. Spoke about the cancer of betrayal. Yes, the cancer of betrayal. What will you say as a final word, talking about the cancer of betrayal that has metastasized all over Africa and it's still continuing to dig into Africa today? What will you say about that as a concluding remark?
I say that the biggest weapon for the people is to be organized with consciousness, to be faithful. So whenever we collectively decide what our line is, our line of thoughts and actions, remain faithful to that. That's the biggest weapon against betrayal. Because again, now the traitors are the biggest weapon of the enemy. So the best way to weed out the traitors is by having the masses of the people organized who are honest and faithful to the line that we established among ourselves. So again, now that means we have to have information, constant information. For example, the example that I gave you just here in Guinea-Bissau, this traitor, Mata Sissoko Embalo, the overwhelming majority of people, they see who he is. They know he's the enemy of the people, which is why now he's not even concerned about trying to hide things anymore. He knows that people have, he's been exposed. And some of the other junior traitors too, they've been exposed because we've been giving information, constant information to people. If anything happens to me, anything happens to the PIC president, the struggle's going to continue. Kabari gave us an example 50 years ago. He was physically assassinated in January 1973, but the armed struggle intensified after he physically disappeared. And it was after that that the National People's Assembly proclaimed the existence of the state, the Republic of Guinea-Bissau. So we're going to say that if this traitor, Umaru Sissoko Embalo, if he touches even one single hair of our brother and our comrade, Domingo Simões Pereira, the president of the National People's Assembly, the president of the PIC, who's faithful to the people, then what's going to happen to him? We're going to get maximum retaliation. We're not going to hide that. If anything happens to Domingo Simões Pereira in the morning, worse is going to happen to Umaru Sissoko Embalo in the afternoon. So that's going to be an example. That's going to be another example for anybody who might even think about betraying these people. The worst crime in the world is to betray. Killing is a crime. Robbing is a crime. But the worst crime is betrayal. Worst of all, being ungrateful.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brother Imani. I've got a lot in line that I would like to interview on and talk about Cabral and Cabralism and then all the organizing that is going on in West Africa. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you. It's been a pleasure talking to you. So much information that you've deposited here for our audience and the people who are interested to learn about the politics there.
It's also wants to thank you because we just came into the program at your invitation, but it's you who took the initiative to start this program, to sustain the program. We really want to praise you for this and encourage you to keep on. This is the main thing that our people need, constant, systematic political education, because everything changes all the time. So we need to keep our people informed all the time. We thank you.
Thank you.